whether or not I believed in climate change or not, right? My belief in the value of freedoms of free speech and so forth, and the need for a kind of an open and free society, so that we can all debate and the thing we were just talking about. Even if I thought, well, that's wrong, no one should question climate change, I would think, and you probably would as well, well, hang on a minute. All right, okay, I don't agree. I don't think people should question climate change, but I'm not going to stop them questioning climate change. I mean, that's ridiculous, right? That's wrong. I wouldn't do. So all you need to do is, and that's happened, I think, in the education system, is to take that kind. I mean, people might think of that as a critical thinking. If we can take that out of the education system and just teach the dogma, which is what they've been doing for the last 40 years or 30 years or whatever, just teach the dogma, then it's that thing that becomes unquestionable. People will never, ever, ever, ever question the pillars. You know, we've got these fixed pillars of where truth lies. We'll never question them. And we can sell anything off the back of that. All we've got to do is convince people that we'll never question those fundamental principles. And it will never occur to them, and this is more to the point, it will never occur to them that by stopping people from questioning it, they are actually doing themselves harm. They are actually sleepwalking blindly into dictatorship.
Welcome to the Fair Food Forager and Friends Show, a podcast discussing personal and environmental health. Conversations searching for truths outside of the mainstream narrative. How much can we grow if we expand our thoughts beyond what's approved by the media and social media algorithms? Come with me and broaden our knowledge, hear some alternate views, and let's make up our own minds.
Fair Food Forager.
Changing the way the world eats
by making ethical easy.
That sounds like a very good idea.
Fair Food Forager.
Welcome to another episode of the Fair Food Forager and Friends Show, the podcast brought to you by the Fair Food Forager app, the world's only ethical social media and sustainable food directory. So you can use this food directory when you're on the road to find ethical and sustainable food. Cafes, restaurants, farmers, markets, bulk food stores who are reducing the impact on the planet by reducing waste, food waste, plastic waste, sourcing locally, finding organics, anything like that. And you can also share posts, recipes, food that you're growing, your appreciation of nature, your bushwalk, your beach cleanup, anything that helps each other and the planet. Today, I am once again speaking with Ian Davis, and I highly recommend you go back to episodes 80 and 81 of this podcast, where we talk about the UN Sustainable Development Goals and the fine print behind those. Today's conversation is on censorship and digital identity and that big slippery slope. You can also find Ian at iandavis.com, spelling his first name I-A-I-N, davis.com. Find him also at Off Guardian, UK Column, and Unlimited Hangout, to name but a few of the multitude of places. So without further ado, here is Ian Davis. Ian Davis, welcome back to the show.
It's my pleasure, Paul. Very nice to be here. Thanks very much for inviting me.
Good to chat again. And your last podcast on the UN Sustainable Development Goals is one of the most popular episodes we've had. I know there's a million topics that we could talk about, But I thought a good one to start with, because it kind of affects everything that we're talking about all the time, is censorship. And I guess that also feeds a little bit into this whole social credit thing. And I know you know a little bit about this topic.
I think in terms of legislation, living in the EU, I don't live in the EU, I live in the UK, but I mean, EU legislation and British legislation are very similar. So the EU brought out its Digital Services Act, and the UK have got something called the Online Safety Act, both of which aim at pretty full-on state censorship, really. I mean, there's no other way of looking at it, really. The idea is, the way that the censorship is going to work is that in both cases, they're putting the onus on the social media companies to have terms of reference which are enforceable. Terms of service, which the requirement of the legislation is that the social media companies, the big ones, you know, but I mean, it's going to extend to all of them. They're starting with the big ones. So they're starting with X, and they're starting with TikTok, and they're starting with Facebook, and they're Meta, you know, so they're starting with the big companies, and they're imposing upon them a duty to enforce terms of service, which then will have to meet certain government requirements. And part of the, both in the EU, so this is across the EU, in slightly different formats, because it's the DSA in the EU and it's the Online Safety Act in the UK. But more or less, this is the same idea. That those terms of service will stipulate what is considered to be information that is harmful in some way. So this is harmful information. Harmful for adults in the UK, and I think it's I can't remember what the term is in the DSA, but same sort of idea. And so who defines what that harm is? So that's going to be the government. The government will decide what is harmful information. So you might think, so what could be harmful information? Now, the way that they very much sold it to the public, and I suspect the way that it will start, so that people don't necessarily feel the full impact of it straight away, is a very legitimate idea. It's the idea of stopping child grooming online. So anything that is, if the terms of service, and this is where we get into digital ID, because obviously to protect children, everyone is going to have to authenticate themselves with the online social media. So that means some sort of digital ID eventually, if all for the safety of children, and also sort of carefully monitoring what people say online, all for the safety of children to start with. But of course, that will be extended to harmful information will include things like questioning climate change or questioning the vaccines or questioning, whatever the government deems to be unacceptable speech. It will put an onus on the social media companies to include that in their terms of service, some mechanism by which they can silence that expression of free speech. Now, the way that the government and both the EU and the UK government have been about them being very mealy-mouthed about how they're going to impose this, as I say, they're saying, no, you'll have freedom of speech. You'll be able, when we wouldn't dream of that, because our whole society is based on the concept of freedom of speech. But you'll be able to say whatever you like, but the social media companies will then be putting your whatever you've said into the goes no further pigeonhole. So, you'll just be in a little vacuum bubble of one, speaking to no one, because they'll make sure that whatever you've said, if it breaches their terms of service, then whatever you've said won't go any further. You might as well be just talking to yourself in the mirror.
Did this stem from COVID and I guess people hearing alternate views and possibly not believing their whole scam, or was this in the works prior to COVID, do you think?
Oh, no, no, this has been in. I mean, the online, I think the online safety bill, and certainly the EU were talking about things way 2015. I mean, you can go back to the start of the fact checkers. So the fact checkers, and certainly the, I think it was 2018, the United Nations started its, it launched a campaign against what it was calling quote unquote conspiracy theory. But that campaign was called, I can't remember the name of the campaign now. But yeah, no, it predates COVID in terms of the intention was there. You could clearly see that the intention was there to limit free speech as much as possible. And then, you know, you've got things that happened during Brexit, if you remember, and you remember Trump talking about fake news. So this is going back to 2016 and prior. You know, so you've got all that kind of stuff going on where they're saying that somehow, and the idea of hate speech, you know, so it's this notion that speech itself has become dangerous. You know, I think one of the things that stands out for it for me is if we think that if we live in liberal democracies, which we are supposed to, which I would argue we don't, but let's say for argument's sake, most people say that we live in a liberal democracy, liberal democracies. Is liberal democracy so weak, so, you know, flimsy that it can't even withstand some contrary opinion? That seems to be the argument. You know, people say things, which is, let's be honest, that has never been the argument before. If we go back to the last century, or go back to the 19th century, and people like Sir John Stuart Mill, who's talking about what is legitimate and illegitimate harm in speech, you know, the idea of legitimate harm was very firmly established in the 19th century. That you could argue that is the foundation of our modern liberal, quote-unquote, democracies. You know, this idea your freedom of expression and your freedom to express yourself, no matter who you are. And I think that was the key point for Mill was, you know, not just that. I mean, it was a different situation because obviously not even women couldn't even vote when Mill was writing, and it wasn't on his agenda. But I mean, he was still talking about emancipation in the general sense that that everybody should have this right to free speech, and that everybody should have this right to express themselves, and that in doing so, you know, you would create a healthy and more vibrant society. That specifically from his point, and it's very interesting if you go back now and look at what he wrote, and he's pretty dense what he wrote, Mill. It's you know, he's of his time. But he, you know, it was very much about withstanding tyranny. The point that this was a protection against tyranny. So if people, as long as people had freedom of speech and could express their ideas. So his argument about legitimate and illegitimate harm was that he gave the example of a rabble rouser speaking to a crowd about the oppressive prices set or illegitimate prices set by a corn dealer. So he was saying if that rabble rouser is speaking to a crowd in an open square in the town, accusing the corn dealer of price fixing, and the crowd is angry, it doesn't matter whether what that guy is saying or that woman is saying causes the corn dealer's business harm. You know, so the people in the crowd go, right, well, I'm not going to buy any more corn off him. He's a wrong, and I'm not going to buy any more corn off him. So that would impact, that would detrimentally impact the corn dealer's business. And so Mill said that doesn't matter. You know, it's a free market, and it's a free market of ideas. And if it just so happens that people decide they're not going to buy from that person, and it's going to affect their business, and that's just tough. Mm. You know, that's just the way it is. But if that same corn dealer was stood outside the court, that same rabble rouser was stood outside the corn dealer's house and was speaking to a crowd with pitchforks in hand and torches in hand, ready to take him, kill him, and was saying the same thing, the same speech, then Mill argued that would be legitimate harm, that speech in that situation So we might call that incitement, you know, when you're actually calling for somebody to be killed or hurt or harmed. He said in those circumstances, then speech, free speech has crossed the Rubicon and become dangerous, because now you're talking about the imminent harm, real harm happening to that corn dealer and his family potentially and that kind of thing. So that was the distinction that Mill drew between legitimate and illegitimate harm. So illegitimate harm. So anything we say online, if you use Mill as a yardstick, anything that we say online, providing that we don't incite crime, so we're not calling for someone to go out and kill somebody or even talking about, you know, as long as it's just an opinion that we're expressing and we're not, you know, we're not encouraging anyone to break the law or do anything like that. We're just expressing it. Even if 99.999% of the people that see that message are deeply offended by it and think it, or even think it's disgusting or vile or whatever they might think about it, it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. Mm-hmm. Because Mill's argument was that your free speech is free speech itself is so crucial to the operation of an open and free society that even I think I can't remember the exact words, but you know, even if the tyranny of a million people thought that one person was wrong, they've still got no legitimate argument to shut down that one voice. There is no legitimate argument for it because free speech is that important. So this was all nailed down and shut, and this was all pretty much resolved at the end of the 19th century. We're now in 2023, and it's like that's never happened. It's like no, it's like that conversation, you know, that social discussion, that massive dialectic that went on for all that time that we resolved. And we all thought that, yep, free speech is pretty bloody important. You know, that's the difference between a free society and a closed society is our ability to express ourselves and our freedom of choice. That's a big, really important thing. Now, it doesn't matter. Doesn't seem to matter. Now, I think, you know, going back to what you asked about where COVID fits in with that, and I think it does fit in with that, is COVID seems to be a point at which, and I think this idea was introduced through COVID, is that the general good outweighs all principles. So all principles of liberty and free speech and freedom of expression and an open, all of that is secondary to the general good, as it was in COVID. So you're all going to sacrifice yourselves in some way, even if it's only a minimal way, putting on a mask or, you know, standing 2 feet, 20, 10 feet apart, or whatever nonsense it was that they were saying that you had to do. You're going to accept these restrictions and this loss of liberties for the greater good, for the common good. So that's what the philosopher Giorgio Agamben was saying about one of the mechanisms by which you would have this persistent state of exception. The crisis for the, you know, the common good is under threat because of some crisis, puts you into a political environment where you just lurch from one crisis to the next, right? So you just go from one crisis to the next crisis, and every crisis requires you to behave in a certain way in accordance with the state's prescription to save you from the crisis. And that he called this the state of permanent exception, which he also spoke much about what the biosecurity state. So this would work through some sort of control of biosecurity. So the idea is that you become the threat. You are the threat. So we saw that very much when you think about it. We saw that with the war on terror. So that started with the war on terror, where you've got all the security checks at the airports and in some countries just getting onto normal public transport, going into schools, which you often get from the American, you know, single shooter events and all those kind of things. So you get the the security gets introduced and we become accustomed to that. So we are sacrificing a little bit of our liberty because of the common good, keeping everybody better. So going through the onerous security checks. Then you get things like diseases come along. So you take the tests, you go for the swabs, you go to the control centers, you get the app. You won't go into the store unless you beeped your app and your app says you're green. You will stay in your house. You won't go outside a 5-minute restriction zone from your house. Where's that idea coming back in again? So now we're seeing that with the 15-minute cities and all that kind of thing.
Mm.
So that constantly ramps up. And if you think about COVID, I think there's a very, very clear trajectory through war. So you get the COVID is the disease element of it, where we learn to take all these biological restrictions and do all these things to stay safe from each other. So we are a threat to each other. And then you go through then that kind of fades away because you can't maintain that for long because, you know, obviously not a lot of people were getting sick. Not that they ever were, but that becomes more and more obvious after time. Then we get a war in Europe. So then we get the Ukraine conflict, which has a massive impact on the economy. So then the economy nosedives, which ironically, the economy had already nosedived because they shut it down for two years, right? But then they got a reason why it's nosedived now. Now it's all Russia's fault because there's a war in Ukraine. Then you get the redistribution of energy flowing eastwards. You get the redistribution of resources with Russia not being able to sell its massive, huge resources onto the Western markets. You get more a kind of this closer kind of resource relationship and economic ties between the states and the Europe, although Europe, I think, are very much questioning that at the moment. And then you get the kind of realignment of geopolitical power. This is kind of happening. You know, you've got this rise of the global south. You've got this multilateralism that's blossoming at the global governance level, which is the United Nations. You've got a war, which is obviously petering out, and it's becoming increasingly obvious to everyone in the world that Ukraine were never going to win it. I mean, why anyone ever thought that they were, I don't know, because Joe Biden was among those at the beginning that said Ukraine can't win it. Everybody knew they couldn't win it. There's no chance that they could win this war if it was a full-scale war, which, of course, it wasn't. I mean, I think that's worth always remembering. It was a full-scale war, certainly from the Ukrainians' perspective, but it was never a full-scale war from the Russian perspective, although they did commit a lot of resources to it. They didn't commit everything to it, notably not their air force. So, I mean, that was one big thing that the Russians didn't commit overly to that conflict. Which is odd, I would suggest. If you want to win a war, why wouldn't you use your most powerful asset, which in Russia's case, it had enormous, overwhelming air superiority, but it didn't use it. That's a side issue we could look at, you know. But then you've got, then that war comes to a stalemate. Obviously, it's kind of settled. The regions in the Donbass have kind of, you know, it seems pretty fixed. Where the new border is going to be, I think. I mean, I don't know whether many people would say that it might shift again, but it doesn't look like it, in my opinion. I think we're pretty much where things are going to settle in terms of the border. And I think most people probably in Ukraine have recognized that, if not accepted it, you know. And then we get another war. Then we get this horrendous situation in the Middle East and in Israel and Gaza. Which can only be, as far as I'm concerned, it's genocide of the Palestinian people in Gaza, but notably in the West Bank as well. So if we think Hamas is not the government of the West Bank, it's the government of Gaza. But the West Bank is under massive attack. And one of the first things they did after the, undoubtedly atrocious attack by Hamas on Israel, one of the first things the Israeli government did was pass legislation to massively expand settlements in the West Bank. Now, that legislation was already progressing, but nonetheless, that's notable. One of the first things they did was to expand settlement or expand the claimed legal right for settlement in the West Bank. So now that's happening. So and if we look at that, it looks like it's an intractable situation which can't be easily resolved, which is obvious. I mean, that's been going on for 75 years that the Palestinians have been oppressed. I mean, go all the way back to 48 and the Nakba and everything like that. So it's an almost like an unresolvable situation. The two-state solution looks ridiculous at the moment. Yeah, I mean, it looks, you know, the whole thing is a mess, it's an intractable mess. So what is the solution? Well, very interestingly, it was Putin, I think, gave a speech at the, it was an extraordinary session of the G20 in response to what was happening in the Middle East. And Putin said, you know, he made some very strong arguments about, do you not see what is going on in the Middle East? Do you not see what's wrong with the situation with Israel? And he very much attacked Israel and blamed Israel accused them effectively of a genocide against the Palestinians. And a lot of people said, oh, isn't that brilliant, you know, that Putin's come out and said that, despite, you know, what they think about what he may have done in the Ukraine and so forth. But if you read the rest of that speech, the solution was more global governance. Key that he said to it was global economic governance. Meeting all sustainable development goals, global security, as in global, you know, global information security, which means censorship. So all the talking points that we might associate with what we might consider to be the worst aspects of the kind of NATO aligned, Five Eyes aligned, kind of oppressive sort of Western. Quote unquote unipolar world, right? All of those talking points, Putin hit all the same ones. And that's his solution. So the solution is always going, and people like me have been saying this for years, the solution is always going to be global governance. It's always going to be global governance. It doesn't matter what the issue is. The bigger the issue, the more global governance you need. So I think one of the notable things about what happened in the Middle East is Gutierrez's stringent criticisms of Israel publicly, you know, more or less sort of laying into the Israeli state and saying, you know, what they're doing is wrong, it's disgusting. And now I can never remember a UN. I know Israel's had a lot of resolutions passed against it and it's never abided by any of them, because these are just General Assembly resolutions, and they don't mean anything. They're meaningless. They're just gestures. But that's the point. They are just gestures, and they are pretty meaningless. And Gutierrez is among those, and he is supported by Xi Jinping. He's supported by Putin, and he's very much, you know, he's supported by this BRICS alliance that are pushing for real global governance with teeth. So decision making at the global level officially, that's what they are pushing for, because they see it as a more multilateral decision making process. So there are arguments for and against that. I am very much on the against side, because I do not believe that global governance is fundamentally a good idea. I think that's a very bad idea. But that's where this is headed, and it seems very clear that that's the trajectory. So that started with COVID, and then it's gone through that period. I mean, it's been remarkable, actually. Over 3 years, it's just the speed of transformation. And I, you know, as I've been watching it, I've just been thinking. I mean, I've been surprised by how fast the transformation is. It's incredible, really.
It's funny how, as adults, we all know that we can not listen to someone or we can listen to someone. If you vehemently disagree with someone on the, you know, on a certain news channel or whatever, you just don't watch it. When did we ever need the government to decide
what's safe and not safe for us to hear. As you said, if it was everyone, let's go and kill this person or grooming children, I understand that. Everyone does. And I'm guessing that's how they'll sell it. But as adults, we can all make decisions what we're going to do based on our own life experience. So why there's not 100% agreement that everyone should be against these bills? Because we have in Australia, I think it might be called something very similar to the UK. It might be online safety, but they talk about disinformation and misinformation. And people who were supposedly from the left and about freedom prior to COVID, they think that these things should be stronger. I don't understand how any of this is helping, but people seem to be asleep on it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way it's sold is very much culturally, isn't it? So it's sold as, you know, there are certain values that we can all kind of agree with to a certain extent. So if we take the very basis of something like diversity, for example, so that's a great, you know, the idea that all people, you know, should be equal, that mixed cultures living together is a vibrant and thriving thing to happen, and that you know, there's really no reason why people from different cultures can't live, you know, cheek to jowl and get on with each other. And so that's all a very admirable aspiration, you know, that most people would think, yeah, that seems pretty reasonable. But if that then becomes your political ethos, that therefore nothing must question diversity, mm-hmm. right? So I have this political or social aspiration, which is reasonable, which is fair enough. But therefore, that's it. It's fixed. It's set in my mind. I will never question that idea ever again in my own mind, which is not what most. That's not how. I don't know whether it's a generational thing or that. I don't know, but that's not my understanding of how we exist as rational beings. I don't go around thinking, oh, I'm certain about everything. You know, I'm not. I go around thinking I'm confused about most things and trying to figure out what's going on. Mm. But there are these certain pillars, I guess you can call them, of political certainty, which I'm afraid to say. And I think, going back to the generational thing, I think it is a generational thing. They've become so dogmatic that they cannot be questioned for millions of people. So if you're an oppressive government, all you need to do is take those pillars, which is exactly what they've done, and start building legislation and building policies off those pillars. And as long as you can sell it to your, I think, mainly younger electorate. So you know, the people probably now that in their you know, 30s and younger, younger 30s, then if you can sell them that idea and say, but don't worry, we won't challenge diversity, is nailed in, right? Climate change is nailed in. Economic equality is nailed in. All these things are nailed in. We'll never, ever, ever, ever question any of that. That's a nailed on certainty. But we do need to censor the internet because there are people out there who are questioning it. There are people out there that are asking questions, and they are fundamentally challenging ideas like climate change. So these people are climate change deniers, and therefore we need sense of the internet. Now, whether or not I believed in climate change or not, right, my belief in the value of freedoms of free speech and so forth, and the need for a kind of an open and free society so that we can all debate and the thing we were just talking about, even if I thought, well, that's wrong, no one should question climate change, I would think, and you probably would as well, well, hang on a minute, All right. Okay. I don't agree. I don't think people should question climate change, but I'm not going to stop them questioning climate change. I mean, that's ridiculous. Mm. Right? That's wrong. I wouldn't do. So all you need to do is, and that's happened, I think, in the education system, is to take that kind. I mean, people might think of that as the, you know, the triumvirate of a critical thinking. If we can take that out of the education system and just teach the dogma, which is what they've been doing for the last 40 years or 30 years or whatever, just teach the dogma, then it's that thing that becomes unquestionable. People will never, ever, ever, ever question the pillars. You know, we've got these fixed pillars of where truth lies. We'll never question them. And we can sell anything off the back of that. All we've got to do is convince people that we'll never question those fundamental principles. And it will never occur to them, and this is more to the point, it will never occur to them that by the people, by stopping people from questioning it, they are actually doing themselves harm. They are actually sleepwalking blindly into dictatorship. It won't even occur to them, because they'll think that the dictatorship they're walking into meets with all their expectations of what a good, wholesome political society should be about, without even realizing that they're completely missed the point of a good and wholesome political society.
Mm.
And I think that's where we're at the moment. And I think that it's very difficult for people that are speaking out, like ourselves, to try and get that across to those that vehemently disagree with us, or we vehemently disagree with them, to say that, but do you not understand the fact that we vehemently disagree is vital? That is really important, right? We shouldn't all be of one mind. This is a very, very bad thing. And I think that is a concept that is very difficult to get across.
What you're doing is you're creating a dumb society, because you don't have that ability to say, oh, yeah, I agree with parts of this, or because nothing is black and white. Everything is kind of gray, and nothing is settled either. Like this trust the science stuff, you know, and yeah, okay, so there might be people that follow the COVID narrative that agreed that the Ukraine war was all Putin's fault. And now they're, you know, they're confused again, and they're like, they don't know which side they're on. Eventually, you might get a government that's on the opposite to you, and then you're the one that's censored. You know, I'm guessing it's all kind of flowing in it. As you said, it's flowing in a certain direction anyway. Because another question I wanted to ask you was, a lot of this stuff with social credit, people will be like, oh, it's China's, it's way worse in China. And then a lot of these Western governments, and you mentioned Putin making a speech, all these things that the UN is saying we need to do, which I don't understand how they would solve the issue in the Middle East anyway. It's not really decisions, because as we said, the UK's got one, you know, Russia's talking this stuff, Europe's talking it, the US is. These decisions haven't just, it's not a fluke that all these separate governments have come up with the exact same policy on censorship, is it? It's not coming from government, it's coming from the global government.
Yeah, it's coming from the global think tanks, and it's coming from the institutes, and it's coming from, you know, places like the Royal Institute of International Affairs, people called Chatham House, big think tank in the UK, but global think tank, really. And then you get the meetings, don't you, like Davos, and you get, you know, the Munich Security Conference and all these sort of things where people turn up and the great and the good, so forth, turn up and decide. We got COP28, obviously, going on at the moment where, you know, they're deciding how sustainable development will roll out, which I don't know whether you've noticed, but everything that they've spoken about so far has been about economics. Everything is about economics. It's all about banking, finance, economics. I mean, if you turned up at that conference and didn't know anything about climate change, you would have to be there pretty long time before you realize, well, what is this about? It's not about environmentalism, is it? It's not about climate change. It's about money. It's about dividing the pot up. and allocating funds for projects and who's going to manage the projects. More importantly, who's going to finance the projects? You know, so that ultimately would be the IMF, the World Bank, the Bank for International Settlements. You know, these are the people that will be the lenders of last resort. So they're the ones that are going to make the money. I mean, that's a nailed on certainty. There's no, you know, there's no doubt about that. That's how international finance works. The lenders make the money, not the borrowers. But it's beyond money. I mean, I'm being somewhat facetious there. It is. It's about power, and it's about global control. And if you can control the finances globally, which you can do through sustainable development, you can do through national security, you can international security. You know, there's so many ways and means by which you can divvy up the pot, so that everyone's happy. And you know, I'm talking at a national state level. You know, so that everyone's happy, and all the corporations are happy, and all the think tanks are happy, and everyone's not that they all will be. I mean, this is another point. I mean, I talk about something called a global public-private partnership, which is this amalgam of international finance, governments, global corporations, think tanks, philanthropic foundations, NGOs. You know, they're all working in concert through these vehicles like COP28 and Davos and Munich Security and all that to formulate global policy agenda, which is what you said. How come every nation in the world is pursuing the same thing at the same time? Well, quite obviously, that requires some sort of centralized coordination. It's ridiculous to think that you know, 194 nations can all be pretty much heading in the same policy direction at the same time without it being centrally coordinated. I mean, that on its face, let alone if we talk about 8 billion people all deciding that they think the same thing at the same time, you know, even 194 countries all pretty much going in the same place. I mean, which countries aren't going? Even Iran is on board with, you know, everyone's, you know, the idea that Iran is the pariah. Iran's fully on board with sustainable development and, you know, international finance for global projects. I mean, there's no difference there. Even countries like North Korea, right, which are definitely outliers, right, even they'll fall in line more or less with you know, the because, you know, obviously North Korea is very reliant on China and so forth, and its neighbors, its regional neighbors. So even a country like that will be forced to fall in line with the same policy, broadly the same policy trajectory. Well, that's because it's, as you quite rightly said, it's being the policy ideas are being created at the global governance level, which I've talked about the global public-private partnership. So the idea is I mean, when we talk about sustainable development, I mean, that has come from the 1950s and the 1960s. You know, things like the, you know, the World Wilderness Fund and things like that. All these kind of ideas of a, and certainly the Club of Rome, you know, the idea of using climate change as a way to control policy, basically. So then all this, the policy agenda gets decided, and then it gets filtered down through governments. So each government is going to, you know, be better placed to be familiar with what its own population will or will not accept. So when we get to something like social credit, and, you know, one thing that I've got into a lot of hot water about is by talking about the fact that they do have a social credit system in China. I mean, there's no doubt about that in my mind. I mean, there's plenty of documentary evidence that there is a social credit system in China. But what they, the only reason that you and I are talking about a social credit system is because China gave it a name. They called it the social credit system. It's, you know, what they call the social credit system this is where it all starts getting a bit murky, because what they're talking about was a genuine way of spreading out financial credit. It was about credit, giving credit to more Chinese people, because they wanted to stimulate consumerism in China. So they wanted to do it the way that the West has done it, which is to lend money to people so that they get in debt. Right. So that's the way they wanted to do it. So they came up with this idea of the social credit system. But at the same time in China, you've got this idea of centralized economic planning and all that kind of thing, and centralized control of all policy. So at the same time, they wanted to use it as a mechanism to enable them to do that. So it's this kind of weird mishmash of kind of, they got this idea of Tianxi, this idea of where things flow. So it's this weird mishmash of what we would consider to be out and out central economic planning and social control. So bringing the two things together to make economic planning work through social control. But then they invited on board their mega corporations like Tencent and Alibaba and Alipay and people like that and all the kind of different the credit referencing like Sesame Credit and these companies. They invited them on board to help with the rollout of a you could say it's separate of a kind of wing of that idea of social credit, which was the very highly technologically advanced element part of it. So, for example, Alipay, they launched this thing called Smile to Pay, which is not everywhere in China. It's like we have similar things, in the West. They launched this idea called Smile to Pay, where you could go. So you got facial recognition. So it's bringing in this idea of digital ID. So you got this. Your face is your ID. So you go and get your face scanned, facial recognition, which in China you have to do just to get a smart card. So just to get a SIM card, you need to have your facial recognition checked in China to be registered to get a SIM card. So every SIM card in China is registered to a real person already. Right, now China have been doing that for years. You go into these stores, you pay with your face. Your face is linked to your digital wallet, and your digital the payment is taken from your digital wallet. Now, of course, what that means is that system is rife for social control. So you can limit what people can buy based upon their credit score, because the same companies are involved in things like they call Lao Lai lists. So they've got the same tech companies publish lists that come from the Chinese courts of bad creditors. So we're still talking about money credit, not social credit, but bad creditors are published. So these are considered to be untrustworthy persons in China because of their bad poor credit, right? So think about that. That's just like, because I'm a bit behind on my credit card, I go onto this list, which means that I'm an untrustworthy person. That's the reality in China. Now, but it goes further because they're also extending it to misdeeds. So what's a misdeed? Well, a misdeed is not a crime. So it's not, you haven't committed a crime, but you've done something wrong, like share information that you shouldn't have shared online. That also puts you on a blacklist. So then you're an untrustworthy person for something other than financial, falling behind on your credit card. So that's the broad kind of system that they've set up. It's not everywhere in China. It's not ubiquitous. It's not like, and I think people get very... One of the points that's come back to me, because I wrote a big article about this in Geopolitics and Empire, that came back to me is, there's no such thing as a single credit score. I never said there was such a thing as a single credit score, right? I know there isn't such a thing as a single credit score. That is a myth. That's a misnomer. There's not this number that is attached to you and it goes with you everywhere you go. That's not the way it works. But that there is nonetheless this thing in China, this social credit system. But my point in the article was, it's no different anywhere else. The same structures are being put in place. I mean, we've just been talking about now, this Online Safety Act and so forth. The IMF, 2018, 2017, they were talking about giving you a credit score for your online activity. So this is that would be linking it to your finances, right? Mm. So how would they monitor your online activity? Well, obviously you'll need a digital ID. How are they going to get you to have digital ID? Well, you need to register online so that you can be safe online and protect, and you're quite right, and protect children. So if you don't want, if you don't want to register your digital ID online to use the internet, are you a risk to children? That's the way it will be sold. And unfortunately, going back to what we've just been talking about why people don't appreciate why free speech is so important, that argument will fly. That argument will fly. Lots of people will think, yeah, right, what have you got to hide?
Mm.
Why won't you show your face online? Why won't you? Are you a danger to children? That's the way it will work. And even people that know that is a dangerous concept, that they are being misled and cajoled and manipulated into going along with digital ID, then you get the social pressure aspect of it. Oh, I better get a digital ID then, because I don't want other people to think that I'm a danger to children. Right? Even though you know you're not a danger to a child, but you'll do it anyway just because of peer pressure, just because of the fear of social stigma. And this is where this kind of oppression, which is what the, you know, we're talking about the sort of thing that organisations like the Stasi relied upon. This idea of society policing itself, because you've introduced these concepts that are inescapable for millions of people, such as the fear of stigma. So that's how this kind of stuff works. So going back to social credit system, this idea of a face to pay linked to a digital wallet, that's been trialed in London, that's been trialed in Europe, that's been trialed in New York, it's been trialed all over the place. Everybody's going down the digital ID route. Everybody's going down the central bank digital currency route. Everybody's going down the digital token route, the tokenization of everything, the sustainable development goals where everything will be tokenized. You know, this everyone is going in the same direction. Every country, you know, the big major economies, they're all going. Listen to what Lula said at COP28. He's supposed to be the great, you know, the great hope for Brazil, you know, the great kind of left-wing messiah for the Brazilian people who elected him, hoping that he was going to bring them forth some sort of, you know, dare I say it, socialist government, you know, right? So they thought that's what they thought they were getting. What have they got? They've got a guy who's at COP28 arguing for global governance. No country can possibly be autonomous. Every country has to be part of this global whole. You know, and I mean whole as in a, you know, not whole as in hole in the ground, you know, I'm not sure quite what I mean there, but do you see what I mean? This, the nothing. I mean, look at that. I can't pronounce his name. He's very funny. Milieu that's been elected as the Argentinian president.
Yeah.
What's the first thing he's done? He's gone and met the Clintons. You know, and he's going to see that, you know, he's gone to meet the Clintons. He's lining up visits to, you know, to go and see the US president.
I think I saw him flying the Israel flag as well.
Israel, yeah, he's going to visit Israel. It's just, and I mean, one of the things that disheartens me a lot, I think, is that people think they can vote their way out of this. You know, if we just vote harder, we'll get something different. There is no choice. There's no political choice. The only people that, you know, unless we fundamentally change our political system, which I don't see any argument for that from anywhere, while we carry on with this kind of two-party state, which people are quite rightly, quite openly, even in the mainstream media, they're talking about the uniparty, right? It's just one homogenous mass. It doesn't matter how you vote, left or right. We've just had our Labour leader. So somebody, supposedly Labour leader, I mean, don't get me started on our Labour leader in the UK, a guy called Keir Starmer, who's a member, as far as I'm aware, he's still a serving member of the Trilateral Commission. He's going to be the next prime minister, pretty much certainly. just announced that, you know, the Labour Party will be pursuing policies of austerity. Right, so what's the point of electing him then? Because that's what the Conservatives are going to do. You know, I mean, it doesn't, there's no difference. There's no difference. They're all on board with digital ID, CBDC, biosecurity, austerity. They're just the same. It's just the same across the board. Mm. Doesn't matter who you vote. All people are voting for are their favourite face. Oh, he looks like a nice guy, or she looks like a nice woman. I'll vote for him, or I'll vote for her. That's it. That's it.
All they have is a couple of small issues that fit with one side or another, and that's why you feel like this party suits you more. But as you said, all the background policy is the same.
Yeah.
So yeah, basically what you're saying is all these, so the parasite class, they're guiding the ship in this way. Then the politicians who do what they say will get a nice yacht or something out of it. And then the slaves, which is all of us, will just be silenced, lucky if we can buy what we want or travel more than 10 minutes away from our home, and we'll just be more farming taxes for them. And that's
yeah,
it.
Man, pretty much. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, we're pretty much being farmed. Yeah, that's, I would say, that's about right. I mean, this, you know, I mean, a couple of things there. So, I mean, you mentioned the parasite class. It's obviously something I've mentioned previously and I've written about quite a bit. So people say, well, right, so I don't believe that we should cast everyone with the same brush. I don't believe in generalizations. I think we're all individuals and we're all different. So how can I say there's this group of people called the parasite class? Well, that I would call the parasite class. Well, you got to look at there's a branch of psychology, right? And it's called elite. What do they call it? Elite studies or elite? I can't remember now, but I wrote a long piece about it. But basically, it's the history of oligarchy, right? So you just look at the history, and there's a whole kind of branch of sociology that considers whether oligarchy is necessary or not, and it's all funded by well-funded institutes that are funded by the oligarchy. And guess what? The conclusion is the oligarchy is not only inevitable; it's absolutely necessary. Without the oligarchy, nobody could do anything. Now there are a lot of people like Spooner that have questioned that. So hang on a minute. You know, what makes you think we need you to manage all our resources? But basically what it comes down to is the oligarchy is considered to be, because they're supposedly, they have certain skills that other people don't have, one of which is their ability to work together as a collective. I mean, this is the irony of it is, so when we're talking about the supreme oligarchs, you know, people like, well, not Schwab, but people like Ben Currier and people like that. And some people talk about, you know, the black nobility and the Orsini family and all, whoever. These people that have got immense wealth on a scale more than nation states. I mean, it's they're in another place, right? Where money has ceased to be meaningful. Money is no longer meaningful, right? These people, the idea is that the one of their strengths is their ability to work as a collective. I mean, that's what elite sociology says, which is odd because we're talking about the ultimate individual capitalists, right? Supposedly, the people that are the supreme capitalists. Yet their main strength as a group is their ability to work as a cooperative. Which, so they, by definition, what they're saying is they're better than anyone else. Well, I don't think that's true. I think everybody else is pretty good at working as a cooperative if they put their mind to it. What actually is, when you look at history over thousands of years, you have a concentration of resources. It's all about the concentration and control of resources. So if you just think feudalism on a very basic, simple level, feudalism is the parceling up of land. You literally parcel up resources and hand it out to your favoured people. And then they parcel it up and hand it down to the serfs. Funnily enough, if you look at feudalism, it's not as bad as everyone thought. There are some benefits to feudalism. But anyway, that's getting off the track completely. But nonetheless, that's it. That's the control of resources. So you look at any empire, it controls the oil. It controls the sugar. It controls the opium. It controls whatever the resource is. It's the control of the resource that you then mete out. And by having that control, you have power, because you decide, fundamentally, you decide who the winners and the losers are. You select who you want the winners and the losers to be. But the winners get your support and they get the resources they need. The losers don't get it. Now, you think about sustainable development, where we're going at the moment, right? So we're having this digital society, which is based upon the tokenization of everything. So everything can be broken down into a digital asset that can be traded, sold. So a tree, right? For example, taking it to the ridiculous nth degree, you could break that up into 500 tokens and everyone could have a 500th of a tree. Right. So, but then you could apply the same to a wood, to a forest, to a mountain range, to a water course, to a land mass, to a, you know, right. So if you tokenize that and trade it as a tradable commodity, who do you think is going to hoover up the vast amount of those tokens? It's going to be the people who have already got vast amounts. So basically, this tokenization of this new global economy that they're constructing based on the tokenization of all natural assets, what they're calling natural asset companies, and they're going to rate everything for its sustainability value. So I mean, sustainability itself can be used as such an acute economic boon if you're in the right place at the right time. So you can call a forest a carbon sequestration service, right? So therefore you boost the value of your tokens for that forest. So as long as you can get a government to agree to designate it as a carbon sequestration service using sustainable development policy, the price, you've just doubled the price of your asset if you hold the tokens for that forest, right? So they're already talking about a $400 trillion global economy based on all this stuff. So they're moving on to an economy, potentially, and this is the concerning point. Hitherto, we've always been needed as labour and as a source of revenue, right? So we provide the labour and we provide the revenue. We're taxed, right? They are moving it, and I've thought about this quite a bit. They are moving into a model of the global economy where we're not really necessary. They don't really need our labour. I mean, what do they need? They don't need us to produce stuff. That can be done. You know, they could print that on a laser printer. You know, they could print that on a 3D printer. They don't need us. So why do they need us around? And I don't think they do need us around. You know, and I think that's, you know, why do they need our tax money if they can create this global economy based upon the ownership of natural assets? They don't need us for that either. They don't need tax so much. You know, they probably need a few billion of us or a couple of, maybe a billion of us or something like that to, you know, to serve them lunch. But other than that, they don't really need us. And I think that, you know, people say, oh, that's just crazy. But look at it logically. Look at where we are heading logically and see if you can see where 8 billion people fit into that equation, because I can't. We'll be right back.
So I hope you enjoyed part one of my conversation with Ian Davis. We'll be back with part two, which is a slightly different topic, possibly going a little bit deeper. As you saw at the end there, we start going quite deep in where this is possibly headed. And as you know, this is a slippery slope, the title of this podcast. You can't have governments who are the biggest liars deciding on truth and then wanting to track you everywhere for your safety, in inverted commas, but really all it is for more control by people that we can't trust. So, and I'll just say it again, find Ian at iandavis.com, at Off Guardian UK column, Unlimited Hangout, and episodes 80 and 81 of this very podcast. And I will include all of that in the show notes. So if you want to click on through, just scroll down. So thanks for listening. Don't forget to download the Fair Food Forager app. It's also here to help you find ethical and sustainable food, and food that is organic, local, supporting small businesses, reduced plastic packaging, anything really to help support you and the planet. And you can share good news stories, learn from each other, and just feel good for a change about the future and what we can do to help each other and the planet. If you enjoyed this podcast and you'd like to hear more, please subscribe where you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review it, especially if you're on Apple Podcasts, and share it with your friends. Thanks again to Ash Grunewald. This song is River from the album Now. Until next time, bye. Together and everybody live downstream, and they call you an activist, call you a radical, and they call you a terrorist. We live together and everybody live downstream. Used to pull like the hood, you're trying to stop me. I'm a death of simple one.